Lecture 3. Intrepid Voyagers, the Greeks.
Welcome back. Last time we got to know the Persians and their traditions about their origins, and now it's the turn of the Greeks. Up until 1950 or so, most scholars believed that the Greeks who were mentioned in the epic poems like the Iliad and the Odyssey, and in the myths about Jason and the Argonauts who went to the ends of the Black Sea, that those were not, in fact, the Greeks of classical times or their ancestors, and that they weren't speaking the Greek language. It wasn't until a young Englishman named Michael Ventris repeated Henry Rawlinson's great translation feat, but in this case for a script called Linear B, which had been found on the island of Crete and in some of the Mycenaean centers in the Peloponnese, at places like Mycenae and Pylos, that people realized that that script, Linear B, which is called linear because the clay tablets had lines drawn on them so that the scribes could keep between the lines like children at primary school today, Linear B was a form of Greek, and all those palace accounts had been written in Greek by Greek scribes using a Greek language. Well, that tied the Bronze Age civilizations to a Greek people. And Linear A, the earlier form of the script used by the scribes at places like Knossos in Crete, turned out to be a pre-Greek language. So just from that one decipherment that happened, was published in the early 50s, it became clear that the Greeks entered a literate world of kingdoms and palaces and very civilized people that preceded them in the Aegean area, and that those same Greeks could trace their line back to the Neolithic farmers who came down through the Balkans with their cattle herds and their crops and their habit for building little hilltop villages, which are the ancestors of the Acropolis of the classical world, thousands of years before the time of classical Greece and the age of Pericles and the building of the Parthenon. Now, we associate the Greeks with Europe. They are a branch of the Indo-European family that went west from the homeland in the Caucasus between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. And then they drifted down through the Balkan Mountains and they entered what is today the country of Greece. The question for us is, how did they become the builders of Greek cities in Asia, which is what Cyrus the Persian encountered them as? And second, what are the unique features of the civilization that they created as they began to interact first with the pre-Greek peoples in Greece and the Aegean and on the island of Crete, and second, with a wider realm as they learned from those pre-Greeks, like the Minoans of Crete, how to build ships, how to navigate over great distances, and acquired a taste for seafaring and adventure. The Greeks themselves did not leave exact historical records about that Bronze Age period, but they left myths and epics. And those myths and epics make it plain that already in the Bronze Age, as soon as the Greeks became seafarers, they began to have connections with Asia. We know from the myth about Jason and the Golden Fleece, which is represented on some pottery vessels, drinking cups where the Greeks would show their mythical stories, and they would show the monstrous dragon of Asia at the far end of the Black Sea at a place called Colchis, where you could get these magic fleeces of the fleece of a ram impregnated with gold. It was hung on a sacred tree. Jason and his Argonauts went all the way to the ends of the Black Sea to steal that golden fleece and bring it back to Greece with the help of the gods. That was one of the myths that shows us that the Mycenaean Greeks, as they are called, the Greeks of the Bronze Age, were already in contact with the peoples of Asia. An even more famous epic myth involves the Trojan War. This is very well known in modern times, thanks to all sorts of retellings in books and in cinema. But it was also well known to the Greeks. In fact, just as the education of a typical Persian was to learn to ride and shoot and tell the truth, the education of a typical Greek for centuries before the classical era was also to learn to ride and to hunt and to know Homer and the story of the Trojan War and of the return of the heroes that was told in that second epic, the Odyssey. And so they would also create images that showed scenes, in a way sort of cartoon-like scenes, of the Trojan War's episodes, scenes such as Achilles, the great undefeatable hero, tending the wounds of his dear friend Patroclus there on the plains of Troy. The Trojan War represented an attempt by the Mycenaean Greeks to take over a city that had a key location. It's a city of Asia. Troy is in the northwest corner of Asia Minor, and it's right by the Hellespont, that narrow channel of water through which the waters of the Black Sea flow out into the broader Aegean and Mediterranean. That was one of the great trade routes. We already know that from the story of the Jason and the quest for the Golden Fleece, that the treasures of the Black Sea area could be reached by the Mycenaean Greeks and brought back home to enrich their kings and their heroes. Trojan War, if it had an economic basis, is probably on the same footing, an attempt to seize a little beachhead there in Asia so that they can monitor that trade and foster their own Mycenaean trade up into the Black Sea. But we also know from archaeology something that's not so plain from the myths. That city of Miletus, the largest city of classical Ionia, the one that we encountered already surrendering to Cyrus in order to get out from under the yoke of the Lydian kings, Miletus, when archaeologists excavated there, turned out to have been founded not by the classical Ionians, but earlier by Bronze Age Mycenaean heroes coming across the Aegean Sea from their homeland in the heartland of Greece, sometime before about the year 1200 BC, and founding a city in Asia. We also know that the Mycenaeans went west toward Italy and Sicily, so in fact, the great colonizing expansion of the Greeks during the archaic period, the Iron Age of the 700s and 600s BC, was simply following in the footsteps of the heroic Mycenaeans of song and story who led the way centuries before those later migrations. Now, this grand Mycenaean world ended in a great calamity that we can't fully understand yet. We call it the collapse of the Bronze Age. It was a time around the year 1200 BC when these ancient citadels like Mycenae, like Pylos, like Tiryns, they all were destroyed and abandoned. And Greece itself, for a period of about a century, was virtually depopulated. Here had been one of the richest, most progressive areas in the Mediterranean, trading with peoples in Asia and North Africa, suddenly put out as if someone turned off a light. And we know that there was a great movement of peoples, refugees from these fallen kingdoms. The Greeks themselves say that this was a time when the sons of Heracles, who they call the Dorian Greeks, the ancestors of the Spartans and other Greeks, came down into Greece and reclaimed their patrimony. That's not the way we would guess that it happened from the archaeological record, but it's a complicated picture, and that was the Greek legendary story, the return of the sons of Heracles, and they seem to have pushed out other Greeks. Where did those Greeks go? Many of them went east toward Asia. They followed those trade routes and those routes of conquest that the Mycenaeans had been going on for centuries. They went all the way to Cyprus, looking for a safe haven from whatever chaos was happening at home. They became caught up in the group called the Sea Peoples, who sometime in the 1100s attack Egypt, and in a great confederacy in ships, try to find a safe haven for themselves there at the Delta of the Nile. But a great pharaoh named Ramses, a descendant of the famous Ramses the Great, puts together an Egyptian fleet and holds off these invading Sea Peoples. Some of them, though, were Greeks, were Mycenaean Greeks, and they settled down on the coast of, well, the Levant, south of Lebanon, in an area that's still called Palestine today. That name comes from the Philistines, and those Philistines were Mycenaean Greeks. We know that from their pottery. They probably came through Cyprus, claimed that coast as a new safe haven, built five cities like Gath and Ashkelon, and set up the Philistine way of life. Goliath of Gath, who fights David in the biblical story, is the descendant of one of these Mycenaean bronze-clad warriors. So there's suddenly a great Greek presence in Asia. But the ones that really interest us are from about a generation later than these Sea Peoples. They are a group of refugees from the chaos of mainland Greece who funnel themselves through Attica and that city of Athens, which alone remained unconquered by whatever force came through and put an end to Mycenae and Pylos and the other big centers. These people are the ancestors of the Ionians of Asia Minor. They came through Athens. They still had kings and chiefs. Some of their descendants could trace their lineages back to the heroes of Homer's time. And they flooded in ships across the Aegean Sea, through the Cyclades Islands, to the coast of Asia Minor. And there they founded, or refounded, great cities like Miletus, Ephesus, Priene. That was the central group, the ones who came to call themselves Ionians, and they always felt a kinship with the Ionians back home, the Athenians. So we've got Athens as a mother city now, and a group of colonies across the sea in Asia Minor who've gone east and founded cities in a place that seems more fertile, more safe, closer to the centers of civilization, further from whatever wildness is going on in the mother country of Greece. They are followed then by other Greeks, not Ionians. Dorians, cousins of the Spartans, go across to the southern parts of Asia Minor, places like Halicarnassus or the island of Rhodes, and to the north, the island of Lesbos, and places like Chyme on the mainland are colonized by the Aeolian Greeks. But the Ionians remain the center, the most populous, the most adventurous, the ones whose mercenaries are desired all over the Mediterranean, because these Ionian Greeks inherited from the Mycenaeans the idea of the bronze-clad warrior. There's an amazing find from a place called Dendra in the Peloponnese of a sort of Michelin man in bronze. These were plates of armor that were buried with a Mycenaean warrior. Great cylindrical rings of bronze to cover the man's chest, a boar's tooth helmet. A big shield and spear would have been carried by this man. He's a Homeric hero, but he is in fact prefiguring those people we talked about earlier, the hoplites, the heavily armed infantry for which Greece was noted, who carried spears, swords, daggers, but whose main feature was this big round shield and the fact that they fought lined up, shield to shield, in these phalanxes, these impenetrable walls of bronze, many men deep, which could move very steadily towards an enemy and mow them down. All of Asiatic, all of Egyptian warfare was based on the idea of mobile troops, charioteers, cavalry, fast-moving infantry with bows and arrows, with spears, javelins, slings. The Greeks were different. They trained hard to master this. They trained hard to be able to fight and run in this heavy armor. And so the kings of southern Spain, that was a man called the King of the Silver Mountain, who brought a group from Phocaea in Ionia, Ionia now being Asia Minor and the Greek realm there, who lured these Phocaeans all the way, the length of the Mediterranean, to southern Spain near Cadiz, and hired them, had them fight his local wars for him, begged them to emigrate to Spain so that he could have them with him all the time. But no, these mercenary Ionian Greeks wanted to go home and spend their money back in the hometown. We know that other Ionians went down to Egypt and fought for the pharaohs of Egypt and scribbled their names and graffiti on some of the ancient pharaonic monuments. So they're getting everywhere. And what do these mercenaries bring home to Ionia? Wealth and ideas. There's a great debate in the classical world today, sparked by a couple of books written by a scholar named Martin Bernal, which carry to its extremes a premise. The idea that Greek civilization owes its roots not so much to its European Greek past, but to what it borrowed from the people of Egypt and the Near East, from Asia and from Africa. He has gotten many people angry with this claim, but the irony is the ancient Greeks would have been proud of exactly this, that their ancestors had borrowed so many great ideas. Even Plato refers to this, so many great ideas from Asia and from Africa, and welded it into a new civilization. The idea of temples with long porticos of columns is from Egypt. The idea of these upright statues, which start very stiffly in the Greek world, the kuroi, the young men's stone statues, looking very like Egyptian statues, straight out of Egypt. Their alphabet from the Canaanites, the seagoing Canaanites that they called the Phoenicians. Lots and lots of their ideas of religion, of myth, of technology, of mathematics, all coming out of Egypt and the Near East. And they come to Ionia. Ionia used broadly to mean the Greek realm in Asia Minor, becomes the core of Greek cultural values. And the mainland of Greece, the Athens-Sparta area, which went through that horrific decline right after the collapse of the Bronze Age kingdoms, it becomes a backwater. It's the source of these populations, but it's being left in the dust by the achievements of its colonies in Asia Minor. And later on, the motherland is going to send off new colonies westward, and they will colonize Sicily and southern Italy, places in Spain like Marseille, places in France like Marseille. These great colonies also will overshadow, for a time, the achievements of Athens, Sparta, Thebes, Corinth, the cities in the motherland of Greece. Why did they go back to Greece? They went there because, as colonists, they still had fond feelings and religious ties to the mother city, and because there were ceremonial centers, pan-Hellenic sanctuaries, at places like Olympia, for the famous Olympic Games, founded in the 8th century BC, and at the Oracle of Delphi, which we talked about in our first lecture, where King Croesus of Lydia sent his envoys to Delphi in central Greece to ask the advice of the Delphic Oracle about whether or not to attack Cyrus of Persia. That was a place that drew Greeks from all over the Greek world back to the motherland. But the action was in those seemingly peripheral zones, and especially in Ionia. What I'd like to do is introduce you to this world of Ionia, because we only know it in reflection through a few works that have survived, like the Iliad and the Odyssey of Homer, and then mentions of other works by equally important people, maybe not equally important as Homer, but certainly very important Greek writers in many fields. I'd like to give you a sense of what Ionia was, what this amazing realm of the Greeks in Asia was like at the time that the Persians came in contact with it and conquered it. Because one of the tragedies for these Greek cities was that they never really recovered from the Persian conquest, that once Cyrus had brought them in under Persian overlordship, they steadily lost their initiative, that great line of thinkers, writers, energetic leaders petered out, and the balance in the Greek world shifted decisively away from Ionia, to which it owed so much. Homer is the most famous and the earliest one that we can name. We're not sure where he was born. Many cities claimed him. The island of Chios said that he was from there. The great Greek city of Smyrna on the mainland, very near Chios, modern Turkish Izmir, also claimed Homer as a native son. What did Homer do? Sometime probably in the 8th century BC, the same period when the Olympic Games were founded, the same period when the mainland Greeks started sending new colonists west to Sicily and Italy, Homer, an oral poet who had mastered by memory thousands of lines of traditional verse about the heroes of the Trojan War, seems to have decided to pull together all the stories that he could and tie them up into two great epics, one of which would show you the Trojan War and its essential conflict focused around one hero, this angry young man, Achilles, who's the leader of a tribe from mainland Greece, the Myrmidons, and who comes from that area around the Gulf of Volos that was also the source of Jason and his Argonauts, the starting point for their voyage. Achilles is the center of the Iliad. It's his anger at the great king Agamemnon, who rules the Greeks from Mycenae, and having booty in the form of a girl taken away from him that should have been his prize for an exploit in the Trojan War. That's what sets the Iliad in motion. It only covers a few days. It doesn't get all the way to the Trojan horse and the taking of the city of Troy by the Greeks. But it is the tragedy of the death of the hero Hector that brings it to an end after Achilles swears to revenge the killing of his own friend Patroclus by Hector, by catching Hector outside the walls of Troy and fighting him to the death. That's the story of the Iliad. Into that basic framework, Homer has fitted seemingly the history of the world. The Greeks considered Homer their equivalent of the Bible, something that troubled thinkers like Plato, that anybody should look on this work which portrays the gods and goddesses in such a strange and skeptical and sometimes satirical light, which is going to be typical of Ionia, the way that they look at their gods. You shouldn't build a religion on something like the Iliad. The Odyssey was the story of the returns of the Greek heroes from Asia, where they had now destroyed the city of Troy after a 10-year siege, thanks to Odysseus' stratagem of the hollow Trojan horse packed with Greek warriors. They all come home. It takes Odysseus 10 years to get back. He has many adventures along the way, seemingly in North Africa and the Western Mediterranean. But he finally makes it home to his island of Ithaca, his wife Penelope, his son Telemachus, and he kills the suitors who have been eating him out of house and home in his absence and restores stability in his home kingdom. Homer made a picture of that lost Bronze Age world of the Mycenaean palaces in the Iliad and the Odyssey. He brought it up to date, showing us pictures of his own Iron Age, Ionian, Asiatic Greek world in the similes. It was the time of day when a judge will sit down in the marketplace and listen to cases brought to him by the common people. It was that time of day. Well, that's a picture for us, not of the Bronze Age, but of Homer's own Ionia, a place of kings, a place of assemblies, a place of feastings, public weddings, woodcutters going out into the hills to cut down trees, to build ships. All of that world of Homer is also in the Iliad as the similes, the examples of what something other is like. Poor Ajax, the hero, hounded by Spartans, is like a mule surrounded by boys who are trying to beat him to getting him to go in a certain direction, a picture of Ionia. So we have a double vision in Homer, the epic world of the past, the sagas, as it were, that are so much like those Viking sagas that were found on Iceland, recording the deeds of the very early Vikings. But Homer also gives us time and again little pictures of his own Ionian world. It was a world of war. Ionia was a place of competing city-states. The essence of the Greek world was still that hill crowned by a settlement that had been part of the tradition since the very beginning. And each hill seems to have been in some ways competing with all of its neighbors, so that there was a great disunity within the cultural unity of the Greek world, a great political disunity. Homer describes that for us in the similes. There's a very beautiful one that sticks in my mind. Achilles has discovered that his friend Patroclus has been killed. He's to blame because he let Patroclus borrow his armor, Achilles' famous armor, while Achilles himself was withdrawn from the fighting. Patroclus went out, and because he was in Achilles' armor, became the target for the Trojans, and Hector killed Patroclus. Achilles, in his rage, no armor now to wear, goes to the trench that separates the Greek camp from the plain where they're fighting, and he stands on the edge of the trench, and he yells with his grief and with his fury, yells so loudly that it terrifies all the Trojan horses, and they retreat. And Athena, the goddess, puts a ring of fire around Achilles' head to show that the gods are with him. And Homer says this is as when an island far out at sea is beset by enemies coming in ships, and the islanders go to the top of their mountain and they light beacon fires at night so that there will be a blaze to show their neighbors on distant islands that they are in peril and that their friends must come and help them. Well, that image of the blaze, the beacons on the mountains of Ionia, sending messages back and forth, I think is a beautiful glimpse for us of that lost world of the Greeks of Asia Minor. Homer is the first, but he is soon followed by a flood of lyric poets from Sappho, the great female poet of the island of Lesbos, who lived near a city called Mytilene on Lesbos. She is supposed to have had unconventional love affairs with girls, and the word lesbian comes from this idea of erotic love between woman and woman that is celebrated or at least hinted at in some of Sappho's poems. But she also wrote about her brother going off to Egypt as a trader and going down to the Ionian version of Hong Kong, which was a Greek city planted in the Nile Delta, so that those Ionian Greeks could get down to Egypt, trade with the Egyptians, and bring the wealth back home to Ionia. Sappho's own brother was involved in this trade, and therefore a man of the world, a cosmopolitan. There were other great poets up and down the coast, and there were also philosophers, scientists, the first geography. We're going to encounter a map in our next session that was created by an early geographer, a Greek geographer in the city of Miletus. There were philosophers who began to speculate about the universe in a way that nobody else had. And here's the point to say that these Ionian Greeks were great borrowers. They were travelers. They saw the world. They brought back to Ionia the ideas of art, architecture, engineering, mathematics, all kinds of science that they found elsewhere, and some religious ideas too, some myths and some cults that they encountered on their travels. And they made them part of Greek civilization, and those things in turn flowed back into the mainland, the heartland of Greece, from Ionia. But the unique contribution of the Ionians to world civilization to come is an idea of knowledge for its own sake, pure intellectual speculation about human life, about politics, about the universe. These Asiatic Greeks, they loved the counterintuitive. This is the world that Aesop's fables comes out of. We don't take them very seriously today, but the Greeks certainly did. Aesop was a Phrygian slave who lived on the Ionian Greek island of Samos. He was probably alive at the time that Cyrus the Persian came and added the Ionian Greeks to his empire. Aesop took homely little tales about a plodding tortoise that can win the race over a very rapid but rather lazy hare or rabbit, about a fox that grumbles because he can't get the grapes hanging too high and says, well, they must be sour anyway, about a dog who sees his own reflection in the water and drops the bone in his mouth to go after the much bigger seeming bone that's down there in the water and therefore loses both. All of these different stories, especially the animal fables, come to us through Aesop, who seems to have collected them and probably created some of his own. We think of them as children's literature, just little stories to be illustrated one page after another in a child's book. The Greeks didn't see them that way. They were used by orators in the public assemblies of Ionia. And remember, this is something that Cyrus scorned about the Ionian Greeks. They meet together in marketplaces, they make speeches, and they cheat each other. That was the essence of the Ionian. Talking things over, exchanging goods and ideas, enriching everyone by this talk, and things like Aesop's fables were used to illustrate the counterintuitive. The race is not always to the swift. The fight is not always to the strong. Don't give up a small thing that you have just to grab at something that looks bigger and better that's down there in the water. You may be going after an illusion. This is the kind of thinking, the kind of mental gymnastics that these Greeks like to get into and that lies at the basis of Greek philosophy. Let's never forget that Socrates, in his prison, more than a century later in Athens, spent his last days turning the fables of Aesop into verse, into poems, so they'd be easier to memorize. So from this bedrock came speculation. I'd like to end with a remarkable poet and philosopher named Xenophanes of Ionia. Xenophanes was a great challenger of traditional ideas about religion. In the Near East, science served religion through astrology, or science served the king through great applied scientific things like irrigation that enlarged the king's realm and tax base. In Ionia, people argued and speculated about religion. Xenophanes said, you know, the Ethiopians say that God, or their gods, have black skins and short noses. The Thracians, the people of the north of the Greek world, modern Bulgaria, the Thracians say that their gods are blue-eyed and red-headed. Well, I believe that if horses could draw, they would show us gods that look like horses. Truly, each makes their gods after their own image. This is a scientific, a philosophical approach to religion, the beginnings of comparative religion, bringing the intellect rather than faith to bear on the question of religion and human affairs, and it starts in Ionia. It seems right to stick with Xenophanes for our closing quote from one of these great Ionians. He lived at the time of the Persian invasion. He seems to have been one of the Greeks who may have fled westward to get away from the heavy hand of Persian authority that brought an end to Ionia as a great independent center of energy and innovation in the Greek world. And he left a little fragment behind which says, "The right things to talk about on those wonderful occasions when it's wintertime, you're by the fire, reclining on your couch, sharing a dinner with friends, drinking the sweet wine after the meal. The things to talk about are these. Who are you? Who were your parents? Where are your lands? And how old were you when the Persians came? This was the great watershed of Ionian history. This was the dark line of demarcation that separated that world of light and creativity from the troubled times that were to follow and that will be the subject of our next lecture, the Ionian Revolt.